Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, South Africa falling behind in the International Monetary Fund growth outlook. Rate cut hopes stir the property market. Why you can't say chicken anymore, there is concern over the meat-free label ban. And Africa's most sustainable brands are revealed. It's Wednesday, the 30th of July. The International Monetary Fund has kept South Africa's 2025 growth forecast unchanged at just 1%, even though it's lifted its outlook for several other sub-Saharan economies. I think this is a sobering signal that South Africa is possibly becoming the real laggard of the region, weighed down by weak reform, political uncertainty, and ongoing low investor confidence. Let me give you a view on that. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Azar Jameen, Chief Economist at Econometrics. So what does this IMF latest outlook mean for South Africa? And do we risk being left behind by our neighbors? So Azar, welcome. And let's start with that headline. Why are we being held at 1% when others in the region are showing upward revision? What's your reading?
My reading is that the general sentiment is that the threatened 30% tariff on South African exports to the United States is going to be held in place when the August 1st deadline emerges on Friday. And the reason I believe that that is the case is we've had a previous warning of this possibility in the form of a 50% tariff on Brazil, not because Brazil is flooding the US with its own products, but because Brazil is taking, its government is taking action against former President Jair Bolsonaro, who is a good friend and supporter of Donald Trump. And so Brazil is being hammered because of its political stances. And I think South Africa is still in the dog box as far as the United States goes, and therefore will be indeed penalized with a 30% tariff. Whereas in many other countries, and some major countries and regions such as the EU and Japan and China, there has been talk of and agreements to reduce the tariffs compared with what was threatened on August the 1st. So relatively speaking, other economies are not going to be hit quite as badly as was previously believed to be the case, but South Africa will indeed be negatively affected as previously anticipated.
And Azar, that could have catastrophic consequences, and I'm thinking particularly of the automotive sector in the Eastern Cape.
The particular negative impacts are really confined to, I think, the automotive sector and the agricultural sector, in particular citrus and table grapes. In the broader scheme of things, they do not account for a major part of the South African economy, but for those particular industries, the impact can be negative and we could indeed see job losses.
Azar, aside from the tariff punishment that you're suggesting, that stagnant forecast surely has something to do with internal political uncertainty versus those external global pressures that you've mentioned, like tariffs and slower trade.
You are quite right. I think what has happened in the last few weeks that has depressed sentiment is the fact that the police ministry has been accused of indulging in corrupt practices. And we know that one of the big constraints on South Africa's ability to improve its growth rate is its very high level of crime. And as a consequence, we believe that the general sentiment towards the country may have deteriorated slightly as a consequence of that. Against that, what has changed since April is the fact that we have seen the budget being approved, whereas in April we were concerned that there was going to be an impasse and just no progress in passing the budget.
And of course, we can't ignore energy and logistics, always cited as major constraints, obviously still primary drags, but the problem surely has become broader and even more systemic.
The problem has become broader. Energy issues have improved without a doubt, but it's the logistics that have not. And the biggest concern now is criminal activity and the manner in which criminal syndicates and organized crime has proliferated and is proliferating, often with the acquiescence of some of the authorities to whom the task of actually fighting this crime has been given.
So, Azar, we can surely then interpret this IMF outlook as a real warning shot to investors, essentially saying, look elsewhere in Africa if you're looking for growth.
Without a doubt, I think the prospects in the rest of Africa are far more favorable. The one thing that emerged from this latest outlook that was particularly noticeable is the biggest upward revision in economic growth forecast was for Nigeria. That country seems to be getting its act together, and we're now looking at growth of closer to 4% for South Africa's major competitor in terms of being the largest economy in Africa. And there are other examples that one can cite as well in Africa where growth is set to improve substantially. Sub-Saharan growth more generally is being forecast to be 4% this year and 4.3% next year, way in excess of South Africa's 1%.
So countries like Nigeria, as you've referenced, Kenya, Ghana, what are they getting right that we're not?
What other African countries are doing is allowing their economies to be freed up from government interference in a large way, and of introducing fairly innovative ways of doing business in each in their own right. And one of the big things that is so different from South Africa is that small business proliferates in many of these smaller economies. In South Africa, the economy is completely dominated by the so-called golden triangle of heavy government involvement together with state-owned enterprises, powerful trade unions, and a concentration of power in large businesses. Small businesses find it very difficult to access credit and to operate in an environment of heavy regulation. And this is stifling the ability to create jobs in a big way.
And Azar, just very quickly in conclusion, at what point does low growth stop becoming a forecast issue and actually becoming a social stability risk? Are we close to or over that tipping point, do you think?
Ironically, South Africa has been living with very low growth now for more than a decade, and the country has not blown up socially completely. And that is because there are certain forces for stability from a social perspective that do not exist in many other countries. Ironically, the very high level of inequality itself acts as a social safety net, because the economy is being driven by a handful of wealthy people and middle class, and they account for the lion's share of what is being spent in the economy. So it just keeps bobbing along at a rate of growth that is not particularly attractive, but which as at no stage collapses into high negativity the way that one has seen in some other economies.
Dr. Azar Jameen, as always, thank you very much indeed, Chief Economist at Econometrics.
#DinnerTimeStoriesSA. Mind-blowing innovative and internationally acclaimed. Le Petit Chef is a gastronomic experience like no other, a unique, never-to-be-forgotten 3D and 4K tabletop projected dinner filled with fun, surprise, and storytelling. Fancy a journey across the globe without ever leaving your seat. You could win two tickets worth nearly 4,000 rand to experience the world's tiniest chef with the biggest culinary adventure. Enjoy six unforgettable courses inspired by Marco Polo's travels, from the fragrant spices of India to the icy peaks of the Himalayas, all paired with fine wine in a luxury setting at Blueberry Hill Hotel. Enter now at events@moneyweb.co.za and tell us about the official hashtag for the event. Your taste buds are ready for takeoff.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee is expected to announce its latest interest rate decision tomorrow, and there is some speculation that we could see another cut. Inflation remains contained, and some property groups are saying the central bank may have missed earlier opportunities to ease policy. So with buyer demand slowly recovering and consumer confidence ticking up, what is this decision going to mean for the housing market if, in fact, there is a move? Well, someone who's got a view on that is Herschel Javits. He's been on the program before, Chief Executive Officer of Javits Properties. Herschel, a very warm welcome to you. So first of all, what's your read on where rates are likely to go this week, and how much of a difference would another cut actually make, given that we're in the realm possibly of 25 BPS?
Thanks, Jimmy. Thanks for having me on the show. So listen, it's my view, I'm no economist, but it would seem to be that once again, all of the indicators point to enough wiggle room for the Reserve Bank to cut rates by a further 0.25% at least once, if not twice this year. Inflation remains at the bottom end of their target, or their current target of 3 to 6%. Some of the core inflation numbers are looking good. Fuel prices are holding, projecting to come down again. So all in all, it does look like there's enough room. It's just whether the Reserve Bank says, you know, that the future conditions remain uncertain. But from a residential property point of view, the market runs on two factors, affordability and consumer confidence. And any time there's a rate cut, even a 0.25%, it helps to improve affordability, especially off the back of the cumulative 1% cut in rates we've had sort of over the last year. And it's good for the long-term outlook for consumers, and that feeds confidence, and that's good for the residential market.
Within your sector, do you think the Reserve Bank up until now has perhaps been a little too cautious?
I think they did miss an opportunity early on when the inflation numbers really came down. Some of our major trading partners, especially the US, took that sort of major step forward with a 0.5% cut and then gradually pulled back. So I think they may have lost an opportunity. But I do say this carefully, that if you look at the Reserve Bank, you look at our fiscus, you look at SARS, those are probably the three pillars of our government that are held in high regard, that have been consistent in their policy. And so I think we've got to be careful about calling for numbers and changes in policy that are going to unravel that uncertainty, which is never good for business and for any market.
So let's bring it to the residential property sector. You say that we're starting to see demand improve across the board. That's a good thing, but is it a genuine recovery, Herschel? Maybe just a temporary bounce, which is driven by an expectation of cheaper credit?
I think early on last year, sort of in the middle of last year, when rates started to come down, you know, there's a saying, one swallow doesn't make a summer. I think that was the view. But there is no doubt that we've seen sustained improvement in buyer activity, in demand from buyers, and a willingness to put in offers, and even buyers going up once or twice. So I think the trend certainly is that buyer demand is improving, and we're seeing it across all sectors. Obviously, you know, marginal buyers in that first-time sector of the market, the cumulative impact of the 1% rate cut on a 20-year bond is about just over 1,000 rand. So there we're seeing some better numbers and better demand. And we're starting to see at the top end of the market buyers coming back, and especially even in markets like in the Gauteng, where confidence has been low, the market has been performing poorly, and that's much more driven around confidence as opposed to affordability.
So if that's the case, then there's also a sign you're suggesting of a rebalance between supply and demand. So Herschel, what does that mean practically? Are we heading for tighter stock levels or a more competitive market for sellers?
Probably a combination of both. So we've had, certainly in most parts of the country, other than maybe the Western Cape, a large overhang of supply on the market, lots of sellers and not enough buyers. And while the market hasn't rebalanced yet, we have seen a slowdown of new properties coming onto the market, or properties being taken off the market where sellers simply can't afford to sell at the prices that are being offered, and less stock coming onto the market as sellers are waiting for a better market before they decide to sell. And we're seeing buyers who are being driven by lower interest rates, and depending on where you are in the country, buying opportunities which are almost unparalleled over the last 15 or 20 years. And that is slowly starting to rebalance the market. But I think we've got still a long way to go before that translates into real price growth.
There's no doubt that for most South Africans, affordability, Herschel, is still a massive issue. In that respect, are we seeing any shift in lending behavior from banks as we might see a recalibration of rates?
So it's interesting, because when markets are tough, when the residential market is tough, depending on how you define tough, people often look to the banks and say, well, the banks aren't lending. But we're seeing the banks lending very aggressively. I don't mean recklessly. So they still have their guidelines. But the banks are competing in the same market as we are, and they've got to find ways to grow their book. And so how they compete is either on loan to value, the amount of bond that they will grant to a client, and competing on rate concessions. And we've seen that the rate concessions becoming very aggressive, on average probably 0.5%, maybe a bit more below prime. So your average lender is probably borrowing at just under 10%, which is good by South African standards. The loan to values are holding, so the banks aren't asking necessarily for higher deposits. And so that is very positive for buyers.
Just a final one then. If we are starting to see this positive sentiment, as you're suggesting, are there particular regions where we might see a price growth first? You referenced earlier perhaps a little bit more interest in Gauteng, which, you know, as one who lives here, is probably a good thing. But where else apart from that?
Well, the obvious region is the Western Cape, which has outstripped the country for some time, not only in property sale prices, but also starting to outstrip the rest of the country in terms of rental prices as more people move into the Western Cape. But I think we're starting to see pockets of areas in sort of your more affordable areas, your areas like Midrand in the Gauteng, some of your coastal regions where demand is picking up again, further up the north coast in KZN. And remember, when we're talking about property price growth now, even if property prices are growing at sort of 3-3.5%, the good thing about a low inflation rate is that you can achieve real growth, which for the most part, property prices haven't achieved for the last 5 years. So that's the benefit of keeping inflation low.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Herschel Javits, who's Chief Executive Officer of Javits Properties. Always appreciate your time, and thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you might be aware that government has gazetted new regulations governing the labeling of meat analog products. That's things like plant-based burgers, sausages, and nuggets. Now, while the proposals are less extreme than earlier drafts, I'm told, that sought to ban everyday food terms altogether, the new rules are still going to prohibit plant-based producers from using descriptors that closely mimic meat. So what am I talking about? Well, no more chicken-style burger or vegan sausage. The aim, say regulators, is to avoid misleading consumers, but some critics are arguing this actually confuses the public even more and also stifles innovation in the growing plant-based sector. So let's discuss this now from ProVeg, and I'm joined by Donovan Will. And let's take a look at the implications of these new rules and what they mean for producers, for retailers and consumers. So Donovan, a very warm welcome, and maybe your initial reaction to the regulations as they stand. Is this progress, or maybe just a watered down version of an idea that was not going to fly in the first instance?
Well, we definitely have to admit that it's a big step in the right direction compared to trying to ban words like burger, nugget, and sausage. which I think the public was completely outraged about. But I think that we're still missing the point. And the point is that the regulations are there to protect consumers. And this seems to us to clearly be something that's been driven by the meat industry to protect themselves. And like you said, it's not making it simpler for consumers to get products that are labeled clearly.
So I guess it begs the question, would there be any evidence that consumers would be confused by terms like chicken style or vegan sausage?
We have been asking for that ever since the 2022 decision to try and ban these products or ban names like burger for vegetarian products, but we haven't seen a shred of evidence that anyone is being confused. We've spoken to retailers, you know, especially the big retailers in South Africa. They're selling these products along with the frozen veg in almost every circumstance, and we don't see any evidence that anyone is being confused.
So, Donovan, regulators say the aim is to protect consumers. Protect us from what?
Yeah, so that's the thing where we are disagreeing, because I think the idea is that we're protecting consumers from buying the wrong product. But in reality, what else are we going to call a product if we have a nugget that looks like a chicken nugget, tastes like a chicken nugget, has a very similar nutrition profile to a chicken nugget? If we have to call it something else, it's very hard for someone to know what it is. So if we're looking for a product that's mimicking a chicken nugget, why aren't we allowed to call it a plant-based chicken style? And we can make sure that the word plant-based is the biggest, or the word soy-based, and just have that descriptor or chicken flavor. In the same way that we have chicken flavor so many other things, why can't we have a chicken-flavored nugget?
So, Donovan, would it be your contention then that plant-based producers such as yourself are being held to a different standard than traditional food sectors when it comes to labeling?
Well, I think a big part of the issue is that the reason that there are such stringent regulations in the meat industry, and I think there should be, is that we have seen so many cases with labeling scandals where we have products being labeled as beef, but they're actually water buck or donkey or horse. And so I think to try and, you know, use that same rationale to the plant-based sector to try and imply that we're purposely misleading people, I think that's the difference. We're not purposely trying to mislead people. If you look at all of the packaging in South Africa, most of it has more than one place on the front that says plant-based or vegetarian or meat-free or vegan. And so we're being held to the same standard, but for completely different reasons.
You spoke about the meat industry and it's possibly behind this lobbying. Is it fair to say that this is maybe part of a broader, even global pushback from meat and dairy lobbies against plant-based alternatives, which are really starting to find traction?
Yeah, yes, it's definitely fair to say. And we've had some pretty good constructive conversations with the meat lobby, and they're not hiding the fact that they are behind this. They are calling for these regulations. And there are some points that we definitely agree on. And we did agree. There was a call from the department to ask stakeholders if we think that new regulations were needed. And the vast majority of respondents from the meat side and from the plant-based side said, yes, we do need new regulations. But what we were asking for is that if this is the plant-based food sector, we should be the ones coming up with the regulations to start with. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it seems like the biggest input has been from the meat industry onto regulations for a different industry. And we think that was a little bit unfair. Obviously, there has been some discussions, but I think when we look, the plant-based industry doesn't have the same lobby groups. We're a new industry. We don't have a big plant-based food association in South Africa like the meat companies do. And so we just haven't had the same input that we think we deserve.
Maybe it's time for that organization to start being set up.
Yeah, 100%, and we are busy working on that. Unfortunately, you know, it's one of those things where we also don't have the same funding as those bigger industries. So that's one of the things we're really asking the government for, is why are we stifling an industry that can be creating jobs, that can be helping to mitigate climate change, that can be making healthier food? We're stifling it instead of supporting it. And so, yeah, we're looking for the government, and we're looking for private sector to be more supportive rather than trying to, you know, treat us as if we're trying to do something nefarious.
Are you able to give me a sense of impact as far as the sector is concerned? Are there numbers available as to the contribution so far of the plant-based industry on the economy?
So it's very difficult to give exact numbers. And part of that's because we haven't been categorizing these products in a certain way in every retailer the same. So it is difficult. But what we can say is that there has already been a definite impact from these regulations. We've seen companies that are importing products that have gone out of business because of uncertainty around this. And we must remember that, you know, we can talk about the local effect, but remember, we're making regulations here that impact the import market, impact the export market. So when we have products from our biggest trade partners like America, Germany, China, they're making products that use common sense labeling. And now we're saying to those countries, no, no, you can't use those names here. You're going to have to change your labeling if you want to have your product in South Africa, which we've already seen in cases like Beyond Meat changing their labels. But that does not make us more attractive to international investors. It makes us a lot less attractive.
So I wonder what this says then about South Africa's ability to embrace food innovation and, as you've suggested, climate smart eating.
Yeah, 100%. And that's, again, what we're asking for is when we look around the world, we can see huge examples in other countries, in countries like New Zealand and in Denmark and even the UK, where the government is getting behind these initiatives and putting money into research and development, putting money into incubators to get these startups going. And we're just not seeing that in South Africa. Again, where we could be spending money on creating more jobs, we have bureaucrats busy over-regulating new sectors, and I don't think it's the best use of taxpayers' money.
It's going to be very interesting to talk to the Department of Agriculture on the story, something that I plan to do. Donovan Wolf, thank you very much indeed from ProVeg. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, sustainability is fast becoming a key driver of brand value. That's the message from the just-released Brand Finance Africa 200 report. It ranks the continent's most sustainable brands based on how consumers perceive their environmental, social, and governance performance. At the top of the list, telecoms giants like MTN, Safaricom and Vodacom, banks like Absa, Standard also making the cut. But I think this isn't just about good intentions. The report also assigns a dollar value to sustainability perception, showing just how much reputational equity brands gain by being seen as responsible. So let's discuss the findings. Robert Hay is Strategy and Sustainability Director at Brand Finance. Robert, very warm welcome to you. In brand terms then, why is sustainability increasingly important?
Well, sustainability has been around ever since, well, I suppose, you know, ever since brands have been operating, but certainly since the 1980s, it's been a prevalent theme. But as issues like climate change have become more and more prevalent and more part of the global conversation, and the linkages that brands have to sustainability have become more and more apparent and part of the conversations that consumers are having, so it's become more and more imperative that they are taking action, and in particular are seen to be taking action, because that's just an incredibly important demand, not just for consumers but for all sorts of brand stakeholders.
So in your opinion then, how much does ESG perception actually influence brand loyalty, or for that matter purchasing decision?
Well, it varies a lot from sector to sector and by country as well, actually. As part of our Sustainability Perceptions Index, which is the core study that Brand Finance undertakes to look into this, we see quite a wide range of roles for sustainability, anywhere from sort of around 3% of total purchasing variability up to about 24%. So in some sectors like sort of industrials, where brands are a bit more commodified and brand plays a slightly smaller role, we tend to see a smaller role for sustainability there as well. But then in other sectors where, for example, with luxury, interestingly, almost regardless of what the industry is, with luxury, you see a very strong, powerful role for sustainability from the high teens into the mid-20s.
MTN in South Africa, and in fact on the African continent, tops the list, if I've read this correctly, in terms of sustainability value, but not necessarily the perception score. Is there a discrepancy there?
Yes, there is. So there's a couple of key points here. So the largest brands tend to have the largest sustainability perceptions value, and that's for two reasons. One is your sustainability perceptions value is sort of part of your brand value. So in a way, if you're taking a slice of that pie, if your starting brand value is bigger, your sustainability perceptions value is going to be bigger. But that's only going to be possible if sustainability genuinely matters. So in the telecom sector, you know, in the supermarket sector, where we see some of these brands that have the largest sustainability perceptions values in South Africa, sustainability may not play the biggest role, but it does play a very, very important role. And because there is so much brand value at stake for brands like MTM and Vodacom, that means that their sustainability perceptions value is very, very high. But as you say, that doesn't necessarily mean that they are seen to be the most sustainable brands. There we see some brands like M-Pesa, Checkers and Woolworths that come out when you're looking purely at, you know, which big brands do consumers perceive to be the most committed to sustainability.
I acknowledge perception and optics are important, but the report, again, if I understand this, measures perception rather than pure ESG performance. Is there a risk that greenwashing maybe gets rewarded?
Well, what we seek to do with this study is to actually measure perceptions, because we feel that's been, in a way, a kind of under-recorded element of this conversation. And what we're seeking to do is to make sure that brands are aware of how these perceptions are kind of shaping their economic future. But I agree, it's very important to look at that alongside sustainability performance. So what we do is actually to map sustainability performance versus perception. And we see some really interesting patterns there. So there will be brands that are both performing well and communicating about it well and securing the deserved kind of economic performance that that would entail. On the other hand, you see brands that aren't doing very much and they're not talking about it. But then perhaps most interestingly, you see brands that, yes, maybe are greenwashing or certainly have perceptions of their commitment that run ahead of what they're actually doing. But then you also have brands that are green hushing, we would say. So their performance and the actions that they're taking are very significant. They're really kind of doing well, at least relative to their peers. But actually, they're deciding not to talk about that very much, or they're not communicating about it in a very effective way that cuts through to consumers. And that, in a way, can be just as much of a risk in this situation as greenwashing. Because if we lose that momentum and we lose that kind of continuation of the sustainability conversation, we might see a kind of slowdown in the action that underpins it.
Safaricom scoring the highest on perception. What are they doing right that other brands should learn from?
Well, I mean, Safaricom and M-Pesa, in a way, that it's something that is actually quite hard for a lot of brands to emulate, because sort of inherent in their operating models is sort of social inclusion. I guess the biggest lesson is to think that how can you kind of wrap sustainability into your entire operating model? Now, for some brands, that won't necessarily be credible. But I guess a broader learning is to think, how can we, you know, rather than doing one specific campaign that might be sustainability themed that we then abandon and you know, doesn't really leave a legacy with consumer impressions, you know, or isn't seen as credible, how can we kind of build sustainability into our operating model over the long term and really make it sort of look like a long-term commitment that is sort of authentic to what we do?
As climate and social risks start to intensify and intensify radically, do you think now that sustainability and the perception factor has to become a bigger part of overall brand value? Have we crossed the abyss in that respect?
Well, in some ways, we're at quite an interesting inflection point, I think. You know, in some sectors, whether it's oil and gas, whether it's technology, we've seen brands either stepping back from some of their climate commitments or some of their broader sustainability commitments, or going very quiet, green hushing, and not really talking about it. So sustainability has definitely been increasing, you know, over the last 5, 10, 20 years as an extremely kind of salient and now very valuable topic for brands to engage with. But, you know, whether it's the situation in the US or kind of investor pushback in Europe, we're almost seeing a bit of a pause in the acceleration of that trend. Now, I think over the longer term, we will see a continued role for sustainability and a continued increase in the importance of that role. And that's actually why so many brands are continuing to kind of push ahead with their sustainability commitments, even if they're not talking about it. But we're definitely a bit of an interesting one where you need a very nuanced approach to make sure that you communicate with your customers, investors, and also governments in the right way at the moment.
Just finally, as we've been having this conversation, it obviously occurs to me that the top performers are telecoms and banks. Where are the retailers, the manufacturers, and the consumer brands?
Well, this sort of goes back to the point I was making earlier around the scale. So you know, in banking, there's a lot of value at stake. And so sustainability, almost regardless of kind of how important it is, will, you know, have a significant value attached to it. And that is a lesson in itself. It means that regardless of whether you're a brand that has a sustainability specific positioning, or regardless of whether you think it's really differentiating in your sector, you do still need to be very mindful of it, say, if you're a bank, and you do still need to manage that reputation carefully because so much value is on the line. But there are other brands, say, in the retail sector, like Woolworths, which, you know, has always had a very strong sustainability positioning, particularly from the environmental point of view, and that we've seen Woolworths do consistently exceptionally well, not actually just in South Africa, but really at a global level in terms of its perceived commitment.
Appreciate your time. That's Robert Hayes, Strategy and Sustainability Director at Brand Finance. And that's where we are going to leave it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.